अस्ति प्रप्तिष्ठकांसस्य महिषा भरता सभः मृते भर्तनि दुःखार्थे आयातु स्म पिता गृहम् श्रीशुकुवाच अस्ति प्राप्तिश्च कांसस्य महिष्यौ भरता सभः मृते भर्तनि दुःखार्थे आयातु स्म पितु गृहम् श्रीशुकुवाच अस्ति प्राप्तिश्च कांसस्य महिषौ भरता सभः मृते भर्तनि दुःखार्थे आयातु स्म पितु गृहम् Shukadev Goswami said, Asti Prapti Cha, Asti and Prapti, Kamsasya of Kamsa, Mahishao, the Queens, Bharata Rishabha, O Hero of the Bharatas, Parikshit. Mrithe, having been killed, Bartari, their husband, Dukha, with unhappiness, Arte, distressed, Ayatu Sma, they went to their father. Grihan to the house. Translation. Shukadev Goswami said, when Kamsa was killed, O Hirok, descendant of Bharata, his two queens, Asti and Prapti, went to their father's home in great distress. Verse text 2. Pitre Magadava Rajaya Jarasandaya Dukati Vedeyam Chakratu Sarvam Atma Vaidavya Karanam. The sorrowful queens told their father, King Jarasandha of Magadha, all about how they had become widows. Text 3. Satad apriyam arkanya sokamarsha yatu nipa ayadevam mahinkartum chakre paramam odyamam. Hearing this odious news, O King, Jarasandha was filled with sorrow and anger, and he began the greatest possible endeavor to rid the earth of the Yadavas. Text 4. Akshohinibi vimsatya tursribis chapi samvrataha yadu rajdanam maturam nuradat sarvato disham. With a force of 23 Akshohini divisions, he laid siege to the Yadu capital, Mathura, on all sides. Purport, the followers of His Dying Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The numbers involved in the Akshohini division are given in the word meanings. An Akshohini was a standard fighting force in ancient times. So we'll look at that word division, so you can get the idea. Akshohini B, by Akshohini divisions, each consisting of 21,870 soldiers on elephants, 21,870 charioteers, 65,610 cavalrymen, and 109,350,000 infantry soldiers. Omagyana Timanandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jaina Tasmai Sri Guru Vainamaha Vanchakalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindubhyabhaja Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is an exciting chapter about warfare and rivers of blood. Of course, what is happening here is Jarasandha's Kshatriya pride has been offended. Every living entity in this world is proud, but particularly those with great doses of passion, namely the Kshatriyas, they are particularly prone to pridefulness, and they generally respond with ferocious chivalry when that is offended. So what is happening is King Kamsa was killed by Krishna in the wrestling arena, thrown down from his sitting dais. Despite his attempts to defend himself by maneuvering his sword, Krishna simply knocked the crown off his head and threw him down, and then leapt down and straddled him and beat him in the head until he lost his life. And he did this in front of all the citizens of Mathura who had came to watch the wrestling event. And of course then Krishna dragged Kamsa around the arena just to prove that yes, he was indeed dead, and now he was no threat to anyone. And after that, after this was all over, there was a bit more carnage to follow as the some other kings and brothers of Kamsa attacked and Balaram finished them off. And then there was a bit of sorrow. Krishna went around and he was very polite, and he actually spoke to the wives of Kamsa and said, "I'm sorry I had to kill your husband." And then he performed the fires, the burning of the body, the crematorium ritual and the rites for the departed soul. But of course, the wives of Kamsa were still a bit sore about that, and they fled to their father, who was King Jarasandha, a very powerful warrior, extremely powerful. Jarasandha, of course, means he who is joined by Jara. Jara was a witch, and you see, Jarasandha's father really wanted a son, but there was some difficulty in getting a son, so he spoke to a great sage about this. And the great sage, was it a mango or sweet rice? Mango. Yeah, it was a mango. He got a mango fell down from the tree just as he was speaking to the sage about this, and the sage said, "Take this mango and cut it in two and feed it to your wives, and they'll both conceive." So this happened, and then the wives Jarasandha's father, they both gave birth in due course of time, but they both gave birth to half of a body, right down the middle. Prabhupada explains they had one eye, one nostril, one breast area, right down the body, one set of toes, one arm, both perfectly. So in disgust, the wives said, "What is this nonsense?" And then they had the bodies, two parts of the body, thrown into the forest. And there they were discovered by a man-eating witch called Jarasandha, who was like, "Oh, how curious." And she took them back to her residence, and she joined the two halves. And then the body, and child immediately came alive and started crying. And he was, "This is far out." And then she approached the king and said, "Actually, I have your I have your son. I've joined him in the forest, and I'm happy with you because you have been protecting this forest nicely, and I've been living here. So here's your son back." And from that time on, he got the name Jarasandha. He was joined by the witch Jara. He was very powerful, extraordinarily powerful warrior. In fact, when King Yudhisthira wanted to perform the Rajasuriya sacrifice, he was pretty confident. Except for King Jarasandha. He thought King Jarasandha is particularly powerful, and he is very opposed to our rule. Therefore, he will certainly give trouble when we when we ask for submission from the, because you can't perform the Rajasuya sacrifice unless you have hold all the other kings of the world in submission. So they're particularly worried about this. Of course, that was resolved by the help of Krishna, and Bhima and Arjuna went and took care of that. Anyway, so we see Jarasandha is particularly powerful and particularly proud. And when his daughters, you know, come running to him for shelter, he feels obliged, I must. Yes, and he also feels that because he's very passionate, his expansion of false ego is very great, you know. He considers this is my kingdom, this is my influence. It expands out. He feels responsible on a wide degree. You know, a lot of us, we just feel responsible for our body, you know. And if anyone slights our body or our ego related to that, or our ideas or anything emanating from us, then we get slighted. But for a king, their expansion of ego is much, much more vast. You know, they identify with their kingdom and their subjects. And they consider that these people are under my influence and they're under my protection. Therefore, a slight or an attack on any of the subjects, or to speak of one's dear daughters, is taken personally. And naturally, being a Kshatriya, you slap your arms, and in rage you say, I will revenge this wrong. So that was Jarasandha's idea. And he then assembled a huge force and began to attack Mathura. Now this is what Kshatriyas do. They protect the people, their subjects, who they're responsible for, and they provide government. They take taxes and then they use the taxes to supply the needs of the kingdom. The what do you call the public needs or the common needs. This is the duty of the Kshatriyas, and they do this by force of arms. Because this material world is, you might be fooled by living in a democratic society that's very dumbed down by a lot of economic prosperity and material enjoyment, even at the cost of the environment. But still, it's going on, so everybody's quite satisfied. They've got plenty of sense gratification. There's no, and we're not really under a threat from aggressive nations. But if you look at history, it's a common thing that other nations would attack to usurp the resources of another nation, the attacked nation, or there's some quarrel. And there's attack, and therefore you need a Kshatriya, you need an army to defend. And also to provide government and law enforcement, you know, to provide the laws, and to enforce the laws, you need also some sort of police force. And that is always done by the force of arms. So, Krishna, what is his reasons for appearing? We hear this in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, text 8, where he says, Prichanaya sadunam vanashaya chaduskritam dharma samstapanataya sambhavami yuge yuge. He says that to deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to re-establish the principles of religion, I myself appear millennium after millennium. So two things: to annihilate the miscreants, those miscreations, this freaks of nature, as well as to establish the principles of religion, re-establish them, because they are eternal, but sometimes they become covered. He descends to do those jobs. Now, when we look at the 10th canto and the appearance of Krishna, we see that the prelude to that is that Mother Bhumi, in the form of a cow, was it a form of cow she actually approached? Yeah, she always takes the form of a cow, huh? That's it. She is a cow. She never takes the form of a woman, huh? She never takes the form of a woman. Anyway, she approached in the form of a cow to the demigods, Lord Brahma, and said, I am overburdened with the defense forces, or the unnecessary defense forces of puffed up kings. This is weighing down heavily upon me. Please do something about that. And Lord Brahma said, okay, yeah, no problem. And they had a conference amongst the demigods, and they decided to approach Lord Vishnu on the ocean of milk. And they prayed, Lord Brahma, and they prayed, chanted some prayers. And then by telepathic transmission, Lord Brahma got a message, and he then relayed it to the demigods that Krishna would soon appear. So this is Krishna's mission, the unnecessary defense forces of puffed up kings burdening the earth. He wanted to cull that, take them down a few notches. So this is Krishna's program. This is one of his reasons for coming. So this Vedic social system, sometimes people have a doubt about any sort of social system, and the doubt is, of course, it arises from the concept that existence is a chance occurrence and we have evolved, and any concepts of government or artistry or language or anything, any cultural concepts that people come up with are simply like a artifice. They're artificially developed in order to meet certain needs that the living entities have in this world, and they just develop a certain way of doing things. In any government system, there's nothing absolute or perfect. It's just whatever, you know, the human brain can come up with to govern the people. So there's a doubt that any division in society, this is a artificial contrivance developed by one section of society so they can exploit another section. This is the argument of the Marxists, that what you have is, if you look at the history of the world and impure social systems, you see that this actually goes on. You see, like in ancient England, you know, first the priesthood, the Brahmins, you could say, they would control the people. How would they control the people? They're intellectuals. They would control the people by creating some religion, some dogma. You know, the Marxists would say dogma. They created some idea of a higher power, of heaven and hell, and of a proper way to act. And of course, they'd place themselves as closest to God. We are closest to God, and the understanding message, transmission from God comes through us to the people. Therefore, we should be respected at the top of society. And what we say goes. In this way, they control the people by fear. What is that fear? The fear of hellfire and damnation. That if you disobey, you'll cause offense to the Supreme God, and then you'll be punished. So this is how they control and exploit the people. Then you have the Kshatriyas. In any society, you always have people that are particularly powerful physically, particularly warlike, and they have a particularly domineering strength of will. And they would control simply by force of arms. You know, they'd gather, by their influence among men, they'd gather together armies and enforce their will upon the people, raid other nations and subjugate people according to their will. And naturally, because of their power, if anybody doesn't cooperate with them, they can simply exercise their power and kill them or control them by force. So if you want to live, you either defeat me, or I'll imprison you or kill you, whatever. You know? And we see this, you know, when warlords raid another nation or another village or whatever the scale is, they often put to death anybody who won't surrender and submit. Any young men who are potentially going to be powerful warriors and grudge-bearing, bear grudges as they grow older, they'll put them to death. They'll just kill them all wholesale. So therefore their power is established. We've got the physical control. And you see what happens when this becomes more socialized and things settle down. You get like the aristocracy in England. You get the Yeah, you get the nobles. And they can, they're knights, you know, they control lands and titles. They have armies, they command weapons and forces. And they rule the land, they're the landlords. And everybody lives on their land and produces grains from that land, and that, and they take a portion of that, they tax. And then sometimes, you know, the people became very dissatisfied with this. Why should these people sit on the top and eat the fat of the land while we have to labor so hard in the fields? They just live in their big estates. Huh? Why should, you know, they're just living very lofty lives of sense gratification all at the cost of our hard toil. And sometimes they became bitter about this. Or you know, the mercantile class and say, why can't we just... why can't we expand our industry unlimitedly? You know, why do we have to be regulated by these kshatriyas and so forth? So there's a rebellion. You know, the people rise up against them and they depose them. And then you have the vaishyas, or the mercantile people. People are interested in business. You know, how to harvest the bounty of the land, how to create, administer economic structures to generate wealth, to produce more goods, you know, in terms of food, clothes, resources, money, produce things that we need, you know, like plowshares and shoes, all the stuff that society takes for granted these days. That's all organized and produced by the brain of the vaishyas. And then you have the sudras, or the working people, the artisans, the people that do all the work. They have the skills and the know-how to produce things. You know, they produce the shoes. They work in the blacksmiths and the forges and produce steel utensils. You know, they build the houses. You know, they labor in the fields. They look after the... they do everything. The, you know, vaishyas are sort of the managers. So these are the... you know, when they become dissatisfied, they rise up by just simply by strength of numbers, you know. They band together in mobs and rebel against the those who are controlling society. So... this is the Vedic. This is what, how we see society operates, and it goes through different phases. Now, people think that this is just artificial, and it's just created. You know, some people think identify themselves will be intellectuals, and they develop some religion or dogma, and they preach it, and because of their superior knowledge, people respect them, and they think, oh, these people must know, and they accept that. Okay, if I offend these people, God's going to be angry with me. This is this is the idea people have, or you know, the vices, the kshatriyas, simply by their strength and force, their violence, they rise to the top and then exploit everybody. Or the vaishyas, by controlling the markets, by controlling the production and distribution of goods, and by creating factories and so forth, taking the power away from the individual artisan in the local village, they exploit things. And the sudras, they never really exploit anyone for very long. So people think that this is just artificial, you know? But the Vedic idea is that it's not artificial. In fact, there is essences in nature. Just like salt is salty, sugar is sweet, fire produces heat and light, nature arises from intelligent design. Everything is designed, there is a master plan. And people are born with a certain nature into the world. Just like, and the social body functions as a whole. Just like, you know, in the Vedic idea, the example's often given that the social body is like a body of a normal person, a man or a woman. There's different parts that perform different functions. You know? there are the legs which carry the body. They're compared to the sudras, who actually carry the society. They do all the practical things. And then you have the belly, which nourishes the body by consumption. So this is compared to the Vaishyas, who produce the organize the economy and produce the food and then distribution and consumption of that. And then you have the arms, which protect the body. They're compared to the Kshatriyas. And you have the head, which directs the whole, you know, the whole thing, that directs the body. Why are we doing all this anyway? So that's compared to the Brahmanas, who give direction to society, help people understand their predicament. Oh, we're in the material world, this is our true nature, blah, blah, blah. Everything. They paint the bigger picture of which our life has context within. So this is a natural arrangement, and certain, you know, when people are born, there'll be a certain distribution of propensities, of natures, so the whole society is a balanced whole, and everything is balanced. You know, there's enough sudras so things get done, there's enough vaishyas so things get organized economically, there's enough kshatriyas so government protection is there, and there's enough brahmanas so everybody gets educated. Now Krishna says, this is my system, I created it. He says in chapter 4, text 13 of Bhagavad Gita, he says, Chaturvanyam maya srishtam guna karma vibhagasya tasya kartaram apimam vidyakarataram avyayam. According to the three modes of material nature and the work associated with them, the four divisions of human society are created by me. And although I'm the creator of this system, you should know that I'm yet the non-doer, being unchangeable. So this is the Vedic idea, that Krishna has created the social system so society can go on nicely. So it naturally works, the social system naturally works, where the sutras are happy. You know, some people, you meet them and they just want to do their art. You know, they like to sew, or they like to build, they like to paint, they like to play music. They like their art. They're not so concerned with, you know, they don't want to manage their own business. They don't want to get too involved in politics and how society should be governed. And they don't want to read heaps of books and just relish knowledge. They just want to do their art. And they're quite happy as long as their work is appreciated as a valuable contribution to society, and that they can do that in peace, and they can have their home life with their wife and children, and they're quite happy if that goes on. There's plenty of people in the world, huge majority of people in the world, who are happy if that's what they can have. And then you have people that like to organize things. You know, if they were working somewhere, you know, they start working for a tailor that produces clothes. And they would immediately think, you know, if I got a bit of money together, I could hire three tailors, and then they could produce three times as much clothing, and I could open a storefront, and we could do big business, and we could market it like this. You know, they start thinking, you know, why should I simply labor myself, working so hard, you know, producing one shirt a day? Why don't I just organize and get together three people who can do that, and I'll pay them, but I'll make a bit of profit on what they do, and then I won't have to do very much. I'll just simply need to organize and oversee the thing, and then I'll make a profit for me. This is called a Vaishya. Yeah? And they do that, they organize farms and everything. And they also, because the nature of Vaishyas is they just want to expand unlimitedly. In terms of economy, they just want to expand unlimitedly. You know, the more wealth we can get, the better. They're never satisfied. Passion and ignorance, it said that Vaishyas are in. And then you have the Kshatriyas. And they are always thinking, you know, what is the direction of society? Who is in charge here? You know, are they doing a good job? This is a kshatriya, and they're chivalrous. You know, they like to stand up for what's right. You meet people like that. People who are very interested in politics are often like that. Yeah? And they're very considered. They're very concerned with the direction of society, and they're very concerned that things are going on properly and efficiently and effectively. Yeah? And they're willing to fight for that. So these are called kshatriyas, and they are supposed to govern society, protect society. You see in any, you know, tribe, you know, there's always some chief that rises to the top due to his power, and he protects everyone, the most powerful person. So this is a natural thing. You see this in any community. If we were just living in a forest somewhere, you know, in a tribal situation, whoever was, you know, a powerful warrior who could protect us from the other tribe, you know, that occasionally, you know, if we're wandering in the forest alone, they might kill us, then we'd want the protection of the strong person. And if somebody in the village starts being a rascal and encroaching on the property of others, we want that strong person to discipline. Huh? This is natural. So this is the kshatriyas. But they're very passionate. They're not concerned so much with wealth, but with power and influence. They want to influence and they want to have control over a wide, you know, a lot of people and a lot of things. And what does that arise from? That arises from a feeling, I am responsible, you know. And they feel gratified when they have responsibility and they're looking after people. But their tendency is if they get very, because the passion makes them so ambitious, they just want to increase their power, increase their power, increase their power. So they start encroaching upon the resources of others. And then they go to war and stuff. And they get carried away. They build up their army so much. And they get fired up and passionate, you know. So that's a problem. That can be a real problem. You know, warlords just, you know, raiding and fighting and then losing. And then, you know, you look at the history of the world. There's so much of that goes on. You know, somebody rises to power and then smashes the neighbor and then they fight back and war's gone for generations and generations. It's kshatriya, you know, it's all about kshatriyas and their kshatriya activities. You know, it's like in the schoolyard, you know, when you get the, when kid gets smashed and gets real angry about that, so he, you know, gathers together a little band of boys and then they go and smash the other kid, you know, and then there's the playground warfare goes on. You know, it's very testosterone driven, very passionate, you know. It's all about power and influence. So that can be a real problem. But what's supposed to happen is the brahmanas are there. And the brahmanas are the teachers of society. They're intellectuals. They're concerned with knowledge. They're not concerned with power, influence, or wealth. They're concerned with knowledge. What is the true nature of things? They're really seekers of truth. And you see this. There's certain type of people, you know, they're often quite unassuming, even sometimes a little nerdy, but they're you know, they don't try and cut profiles in the playground when they're young kids. They often prefer to be in the library reading a book, and they're really concerned with knowledge. How do things work? Huh? How does, and you know, the ultimate, the height of that is what is life? What is existence? What is God? You know, what is the true nature of things? That's the paramount, or the pinnacle of that type of seeking propensity, that knowledge acquiring propensity. And they become professors in universities and so forth. But the brahmanas are supposed to be the teachers of society. So they actually teach the kshatriyas, the young princes and so forth rising up. They get taught by the brahmanas. And they get taught virtue and values and also arts, you know, the different arts that they need to do their government and do everything like that. They get taught by the brahmanas. So they're supposed to imbibe a internal set of values from their teachers, as well as a lot of respect for the brahmanas. And you see, the brahmanas, people respect them, not because of their strength, but because of their knowledge, and also because they're renounced, they're detached. They generally live very simply. This is the idea of a Brahmana should live simply, simply on charity, and should not endeavor himself for maintaining himself. He should simply live on charity, very simply. Whatever comes, I take that. He's dependent, what? On the Lord. And that is their respect. And therefore, they're supposed to get from a young age, and just the social etiquette is that the Kshatriyas, they should respect the Brahmanas. And then the Brahmanas advise, and through this advising capacity, they regulate the passion of the Kshatriyas. You know, you're getting carried away. You know, don't forget the real goal of life, you know. All this will pass. What about the supreme goal? What about Dharma? They regulate the Kshatriyas. And they do that from a position of neutrality and partiality. They're not being paid by their government, you know. Like what you see the Brahmanas today, they're paid. And therefore, if they say something contrary, then they get... then they just say, well, look, if you say things that displease us or go against our sort of ambitions, then you'll lose your job, you'll lose your means of maintenance. And then you'll be in trouble. Your wife will be hassling you. You know, how are we going to feed the kids? Yeah. So the Brahmana becomes, you know, the so-called intellectual becomes bound by a wage. But in the Vedic system, this doesn't happen, you know, because the Brahmanas, because of their spiritual knowledge and their detachment, they just depend on the Lord. Therefore, they can advise the king impartially. They just say, well, you know, you're actually being a bit of a fool here. You're getting carried away. I recommend that you do this. And also, they're not attached. They give that advice, and then they say, now do what you want. But because the Kshatriyas are supposed to respect the Brahmanas, and we see even Jarasandha, he has great respect for Brahminical culture due to his Vedic context of his existence. Huh? They're supposed to respect, and therefore, because the Kshatriyas, they don't want to stand up on a pedestal and say, hey ye all citizens, this is how everything will go on, you know, and organize and, you know, what do you call, mediate between disputes and pass judgments and execute people. They don't want to do any of that. They just want to study and contemplate and worship the Lord. Huh? So they do that through the Kshatriyas, advise them, and then the passionate Kshatriyas go out there and govern society. That's how it's supposed to go on. So actually, if we analyze this, and then the Kshatriyas, they regulate the Vaishyas. They regulate the Vaishyas, who then provide the so the Vaishyas don't become dishonest in their business. You know, just like today, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But, and then the Sudras, they're happy because they're serving. They've got good masters and things are going nicely. They're making a valued contribution and society is peaceful. So they're happy. This works. But what do we have today? You know, in the past centuries, the aristocracy, the nobles in... For a long time ago, the church was thrown out as the government head. And this is in the Western political history. That was thrown out. And then the monarchies, the kings, the nobles, they were also... there was a revolution that went on and they lost their power to the Vaishyas, who wanted a free economy. And then the Vaishyas have risen to power, and that's what we have today. We have... The world is actually ruled by corporations. Massive businesses, huh? And they want to expand their wealth unlimitedly, basically. So therefore the Vaishyas now, they're pushing for globalization. Why globalization? Because, for example, a product like a Nike shoe, if I produce that in Australia, I have to pay like wages of people $15 an hour, something like that. And I have to buy all these things, and I produce, and then I make some profit. That's okay. But if we have a global economy, I can just go to China, and I can just talk to some viceroy over there and say, look, I want to make such and such shoes, in your factory, will you do that for me? Here's the intellectual property, the system how to do that. Can you implement this in your factory? How much will it cost per unit? And then they hire all these, common people, pay them practically nothing, produce hundreds and thousands of shoes in these massive factories, shipping in resources, you know, Vaishyas, they have their technologies now to do that. And then they produce a shoe, instead of maybe costing them $40 to produce a shoe that they sell for $120, they can produce it for $5 or $2. And then they sell it for $120 and make, you know, 10,000% profit or whatever it is, you know. And they're very happy, they're thinking, good. And if we can just produce more of these. And then what can we do? What we do is we'll saturate society with advertising. Through the TV, through the media. We'll create a situation where we turn everybody into a maha consumer. And therefore our business will grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And what about the government? Well, the government should be in our pocket. And the democratic system that was established after the depose of the monarchy, that is very suitable to the Vaishyas, because then nobody's really got any power. You know, even the government, they've got all their ministers and everything's got to be voted. And, you know, things are controlled by the media. You know, if you want to make a statement to the people and tell them about your virtuous vision for society, you've got to go through the media, which is controlled by the corporations. So the corporations say, well, you guys, you're getting a bit too pious. You know, you're going to, we want consumers. We want a society of consumers. So therefore, they control politics as well. And how are they also? Because there's a very good definition of state. What is the state? State is that entity which has the monopoly on legitimized violence. State is that entity which controls the monopoly on legitimized violence. What does that mean? That means, okay, we're the state. We have a certain law. We have a certain policy. We want to enforce that on the people. What do? We pass resolutions. We pass laws. We establish them. And the people must follow them. How are we going to enforce that? Legitimized violence. If you break the law, we can come and grab you, beat you with a baton if necessary, pull a gun on you, and take you to prison. Yeah? And you see this in tyrannical governments. You know, they just control the people by fear and force. They take people away, like what's happening in China. They just, anybody who doesn't follow the communist idea, like the Falun Gong practitioners, who Qigong, which is massive over there, millions of people, they're scared because this is a huge group with a different ideology to that of the government. Even though they're very peaceful people, they think this is a threat, you know. This could pretend, this imbalances our power. Therefore, we just take these people, snatch them off the street, torture them, and then sell their organs to hospitals. You know? It's horrendous. This is a tyrannical government. And they just stand at the top, and this is law, and they control the people by fear. And in a democratic society, you also see that's what's going on, but it's much more, you know, the policeman, if you would disobey a law, you know, just like Bob Marley, you know, he went to the American countries, you know, he was doing concerts and stuff. And they're saying, you smoke marijuana, don't you? This is a reporter speaking to him, and he says, yeah. And they were saying, don't you know that that's illegal? He said, who made that illegal? Yeah. Did God make it illegal? Yeah. In his conception, no, it's just a herb of the earth. Did God make it illegal? No, it's the minds of men that have decided to make this illegal. But, you know, so this person didn't really catch his concept, you know. It was a bit too sort of broad for them. So the reporter just started asking other questions. But the idea is, you know, that somebody's decided, you know, this is going to be illegal. For example, in Kazakhstan, they're you know, saying that devotees can't do their thing. And they're bulldozing their houses and taking their land and all sorts of horrible things. So the government makes this plan and then they just control it by force. But the thing is, we're so dumbed down, we just think, you know, the laws, you know, they're absolute and they're divine and we just must follow them, and I shouldn't jaywalk and I shouldn't this, or I must pay my parking fines. Otherwise, you know, what is the... It's actually fear that's there. That you'll be... So the state is that entity which controls the right, controls the monopoly on legitimized violence. They can just come and grab you if they don't like what you're doing according to their laws. And the diplomatic idea is that the people decide the laws and therefore it's all okay. But it doesn't actually work like that. The corporations decide how society moves. The Vaishyas. So this way things become unbalanced. when it actually all starts when the the influence of the brahmanas breaks down. And then they lose control over the kshatriyas get too passionate and unbalance the world with unnecessary defense forces. And then the Vaishyas rebel against the kshatriyas. And you also see another thing, that the kshatriyas have no power these days. Because imagine if you're a proud kshatriya and you go into battle and you draw your sword and you go, by the strength of my arms, by my bow, I'm going to defeat you in battle. And then some sudra with a Gatling gun just goes, and you're finished, you know. So what controls war these days? Technology. And how to get more technology? Money. It's all that matter of economics. That's what a war is these days. You know, they got bombs and stuff that you can just wipe out. You don't worry if you're a powerful kshatriya. That's why in the Wild West, when the gun came along, you know, the hand gun, that was called the great equalizer. Because you can be like a strutting, powerful, chivalrous cowboy, and some kid can pull a gun on you and blow you away, you know. It's not, the strength of your arms doesn't mean squat. Or that you can be a trained ninja in Japan or China, you know. Trained for many years in a Shaolin temple, you know, with this awesome kung fu martial arts and stuff, and somebody just comes along, all they need to do is pull a trigger. And now you've got bombs, you've got tanks, it's all a matter of, you've got flamethrowers, you know, it's all a matter of economy. And these days, the question in warfare is not, you know, how powerful the individual is, it's how quickly we can supply powerful technology to the battlefield. Because it just gets chewed up so quickly, bombs and missiles and guns and people just falling by the thousands, hundreds and thousands. Yeah? And it's actually the general who sits in a bunker somewhere and just, you know, by email or whatever directs the armies, you know. But this is not the Vedic way. There's no technological weapons. Of course, there's mystic weapons, but that also requires prowess. So therefore, the kshatriyas had influence because of their power. These days, no, the big businesses who can buy the most weaponry, they have the power. You know, the people who can hire the biggest defense force, because you know, it's all hired, you know, these days. You hire them, you equip them with the latest weapons, which are like, you know, these days you can get a gun that feels like a toy, it's like plastic, you know. But if you point it at somebody and pull the trigger, they'll basically become a bloody mist within a couple of seconds, you know. It's finished. So, yeah, the kshatriyas have no power. So this way things are imbalanced in the modern world. And, you know, the brahmanas have no purity. Kshatriyas have no power and they've lost their manliness and their influence. They're angry, they don't have any sense control, they're not regulated. The Vaishyas are just like controlling everything. The sudras are completely dissatisfied because they, you know, there's a big, when the Industrial Revolution started in England, there was a big uprising from the common workers. They were dissatisfied because now, you know, their you know local industry, village industry, was becoming obsolete by the influence of the factory. The Vaishyas had discovered, you know, if we create something called a factory, and we turn everything into a production line, and we just ship in a huge amount of resources and push them through our production line, you know, we can produce, like, stuff that's better, we can do it faster, and we can do it cheaper and undersell everybody. You know, like what we have these days, the chain store. Any small business, you know, you know, if say you're producing shoes or clothes, you know, now you can just get undersold by somewhere, some massive corporation who just comes in and brings in 1 million t-shirts from China, sells them at like a tenth of the price, and suddenly you've got, so what do? You have to go then, in order to survive, you have to go begging to the corporation, please employ me. So the Vaishya, you know, the small-time Vaishya is lost to the big fish Vaishya, you know, the corporation. And then the Sudras, they're completely dissatisfied because all they end up doing is like pushing buttons on machines or getting pushed into offices to push paper, you know. Well, these days it's all digital to process information. And even offices, you know, in the lower echelons, they're just, it's just another type of factory, you know, you get a little job and you answer phones or something like that. You just do that all day. There's no real satisfaction in the art. for the sutra. So the whole thing's unbalanced. So anyway, Krishna comes. He says, I come to correct this imbalance. So, yeah. This is very interesting topics. They're not super practical to our daily life in Krishna consciousness. They're just moving around the temple and doing our service, but they're interesting on sort of the greater, the big picture of society. So I guess we'll stop there. Is there any questions or comments on these points? Prabhu? Yes?
I have two questions. So first of all, we in the Dhumana call the Shudras. So still we can see certain tendencies in women that like certain ages, for example, Drupadi is not an also Kshatriya and all that. But so what is the difference of how does the nature get expressed in the man and the woman, and what's the difference between
them? It's not true that a woman are sutras. That's not the idea. Because you see that many times in the Bhagavatam that there was a marriage between a Kshatriya woman and a Brahmana, for example, Kadama Muni.
Yeah.
And what was her name? I forgot. Devahuti, of course. Yeah, she was a she came from the Kshatriya order. She was the daughter of one of the Manus. Is that right? Yeah. Daughter of Svayambhuva Manu. So she was a Kshatriya. And he was a Brahmana, so her caste was taken into consideration, which wasn't that she was a Sudra. But, and you see also, you know, the queens and so forth in the palaces in the Vedic times, you know, the Kshatriya queens, they would organize the domestic side of the palace. You know, they're still, they've got their subjects, you know, and they, you know, while the, you know, the king, he might be concerned with the greater society and organizing that. The queen in the household, she'd organize the palace, and she'd have her maidservants. She'd have a great influence, you know, in the womanly court, and she'd still act in the capacity of the Kshatriya because that's her nature, but she'd do it in a different field. Yeah, and in the Vedic times, the idea is that the man should protect the women, and on a practical basis. That means, you know, let's go back to a tribal setting. You know, you've got some savage tribe attacking, you know. Is the woman going to, you know, pull out her, you know, kitchen knives or whatever, or and like, defend herself? Or is she going to go, oh, you know, to the powerful men of the village who have got that kind of... Women don't have the propensity to fight physically. It's like, ah! So they go to the palace, and therefore the man they control simply because they protect simply because of their physical strength, physical power. These days, you know, it's not so important. And also the men would provide, you know. They'd work the fields, they'd deal in the markets, they'd do all the hard work, so they could provide for the woman who was, you know, if she did get married, she'd have children. That's a big job. You can't. It's very difficult to do that and also plow the fields and defend yourself from aggressors. So therefore, the combination worked nicely, you know. But these days, you have, if you become a single woman, you know, the police are there to protect you, for a start, and the government also give you money. So therefore, why do you actually even need a man to look after you? You don't. That's what a lot of women think, you know. Therefore, if the man is a bit rough or unqualified, or just the woman gets sick of him, just leave him. And also, the man feels often disempowered because, you know, he has this propensity to look after and protect. I mean, of course, that needs knowledge to be done effectively. And he feels really bad because, you know, he doesn't feel needed. Yeah? He's got nothing to be responsible for, so he feels bad, you know. So, there's some points. Do you want to expand your question?
So, you mean that basically, if you have affinities, this is what the difference is between the Kshatriya woman and Kshatriya man?
Yeah.
Okay. And another question is,
but also the Vaishyas as well?
Yeah, for example. Another question is, if you feel you have a certain nature, might be a sort of idea
guidance. That's why the Kshatriya is supposed to take guidance. And now there's two things. You can either transcend your nature, and you can do that by intense chanting of Hare Krishna, but most of us, you know, we're influenced by our conditioned nature, even though we might be somewhat detached by dint of the virtues of devotional service. But still we might be somewhat influenced by that. So then we have to use that. But one thing that is definitely a fact in this day and age is that it's called Vana Sankara. Everybody's mixed up. It's very hard to know exactly what your nature and propensity is. It takes a lot of honest self-reflection, and it takes some time of chanting Hare Krishna. Prabhupada said, let them chant for 1 year. And then, if they chant 16 rounds for 1 year, then they'll begin to understand their nature. And these days, it's even longer, you know. Like, our Guru Dave, you know, he says, at least 2 years normally for most people. He says it takes, but then he says it takes 10 years really for people to really settle down and understand what devotional service is, become a full-fledged human being in goodness, and then they can really look at themselves and say, yeah, well, this is my nature, this is my propensity. It takes a lot of time. Because there's two issues attached. One is the ego issue, and the other is the issue of stigma. You know, nobody wants to be a fourth-class man. Nobody wants to admit that, you know, I'm a sudra. Everybody, at least a second class, if not a first class. So this is also, of course, false ego identifying with the body, and it can also be enforced by the culture that we're living in. You know, everybody wants to be the best, but actually that's not the way Krishna looks at things. You know, just like you don't think my legs are inferior. You know, my head's sitting on the top, feeling very proud because it's superior to the legs and the arms. No, the body understands I'm an integrated whole. If we all work together, things are going nicely. The legs are satisfied being legs. The arms are satisfied being arms. The belly's happily digesting. And the head's thinking about things, you know. So this is, you know, when we become a little more mature, we become less attached to, like, some mental concoction of superior and inferior. And we just think, well, what is my nature? How can I best contribute to society? So those two issues of ego and stigma, you know, the stigma attached to being the lowest and the ego wanting to be the highest, they stop honest self-reflection. So that takes some time of maturing, settling into devotional service, becoming less attached to the desires for ego gratification. And then one can really reflect honestly and through guidance, understand how one's best engaged. So it takes time. And these days, you know, we have to wear so many hats. Like sometimes you have to do some management, you know. The ashram, there's a quarrel in the ashram, and you have to manage. Somebody has to manage that, you know. So they step in and mediate and things. And sometimes things have to get done, you know. So you say, come on everyone, let's do it, you know. And somebody takes control. And sometimes you need to organize to make some money. Or sometimes, you know, you just have to clean the toilets. So you get to put on so many hats. And this is the nature of devotional service, you know, do what needs to be done. But eventually what we should do is find as our main service what fits best with our nature. In order to understand our nature, that takes time. I thought of another point in regarding to your first question about womanhood. And this is what Ravindra Swarup says. It's very interesting. He says that, you know, these days, with education and so forth, you can turn a woman into a pretty good corporate executive, you know. Powering, making decisions, you know, controlling, sitting on top of a corporation, doing pretty good, you know. You can do that. You can even turn her into a pretty good soldier these days. You get women that just want to be soldiers, and they can command tank divisions, you know. you can turn practically anybody into anything with enough education. But the question is whether they'll be comfortable there, and whether that's the best contribution to society. And then he makes the point, you know, what society does need is mothers. Mothers are so important because they bring forth the next generation. They raise the children up, they nurture, they provide the whole... mothers are also wives, they provide the backdrop or the nurturing. They actually provide community. You know, men, male community is quite fickle, you know. women have much more tendency to want to bring the community together, community events, it should be society, everything should go on nice, you know, that everybody should get treated kindly. So this comes from the womanly, motherly propensity. And so we need that. These days, you know, men sometimes they want to be mothers, they want to look after and stay at home. But he makes the point, Marindra Sarup makes the point, he's very, always very broad and humble and doesn't like to make absolute statements. So he says, I conjecture that, you know, in society, if we want things to go on really nicely, what we need is specialists. We need people who specialize in certain things. And my just conjecture, you know, I'm not trying to enforce a dogma on anybody, but my conjecture is that the best person to be mothers are women. Just an idea, you know. And the best person to be like men, masculine, controlling, protecting, you know, ambitious, just possibly are men. You know, it's true that they either can do both, you know. But if one specializes in a certain role, then one will do it. And if one's like got the most potential for that role, then one will perform with excellence. And you know, you see men try to look after kids, and after a while they get just too much. They lose their patience, but a woman has boundless patience for the child. And although she might get strict and firm, she never loses her love and affection. When the man is emotionally inclined, easily turns to detachment, you know. Anyway, get rid of this screaming brat, you know. And therefore they can't nurture in the same way. So there's some ideas from Vinay Sarup which I found very interesting. If you want to listen to those points, and also a lot of the points in this lecture come from this talk that I gave today come from a lecture series by him called Foundation Principles for Vanashram Dharma. And I have that if anybody wants it.
You mentioned the word dogma a couple of times. What's the definition of that? Because we saw it on a number plate.
Dogma?
Yeah.
Dogma is when I enforce a view with an unreasonable amount of force upon somebody else, you know. If I just say, you know, Pinocchio died for our sins, you know. Huh? And I give you no reasoning. If you don't follow Pinocchio, if you don't believe, you're going to hell. Or if I just say, you know, like, you know, just any forceful view that's explained without reason. Huh? Any just strict holding to some point of view just because one doesn't want to admit defeat. This becomes dogma. Or some, you know, dogmas often perpetuated over generations because, you know, the forefathers, they started doing something a certain way for a certain reason. And then the next generations just followed the tradition, the next generation followed the tradition, and eventually, you know, so why do you do that anyway? Well, that is the way! It's the only way, you know. You know, and you're for, or, you know, that's just the way we do it, you know, it's unreasonable. It becomes like a dogma. That's called a dogma. You know, or if I just make up some story about, you know, the Godhead and how I'm the closest to the God, and, you know, this is the idea in the context I used it, the priests, you know. The idea was they made up some religious dogma that salvation must be attained by worshipping the priests, you know. And nobody can prove it right or wrong, but they push it with such force it becomes a dogma and everybody just like succumbs to it out of fear. So it's like a forceful, unreasonable idea. Yeah. Did you want to?
Do you want to add something about Govinda Ghosh?
Govinda Ghosh? Don't know anything about Govinda Ghosh. I'm ignorant. Sorry. Any last points? Well, thank you so much for listening. Gonchad Srimad Bhagavatam ki.
Jai.